Yeah, I guess I'll go in English. Okay. So what we're gonna do is I'm gonna give a briefing, maybe about an hour or so, and Pascal is going to give a briefing about the Conference of the Americas where Luke and Pascal were, and then after, I mean, we should have some Q&A, and in order to kind of conclude, there's a little exercise around geometry I wanted to do. Something I figured out during the last weekend, and I wanted to share the pain because it took a lot. It was fun, but you know, when you think of dealing with, you know, you start when the first time you deal with root two, you know, you're kind of confused. What the hell is root two? And when you deal with the root 2/4 of the root, and a series of numbers that have like four or five roots in it, then you know you're getting somewhere. So that's I wanted to just show that later, but first, we have a small group here, but I think everyone has at least a bit of experience with organizing. Maybe not a lot, but enough to know that there is a necessity for us to keep organizing. And a question that comes up that and comes up a lot since this organizing that we do around Obama and the Nazi healthcare reforms is people are just asking basically, well, why this? Of all the issues in the world, you know, poverty in Africa, AIDS or whatever, you know, poverty in general, why did you pick that? And the first thing I had in mind was to say, well, look, we gotta any serious movement has to go at the root of the story, or the root of the issue, if you want. And it has nothing to do with the number per se. Even if we were like 1 billion people in the LaRouche movement, it doesn't mean that, hey, now we can deal with all these issues together, right? Poverty there, you know, injustice there. But actually you stick to the root of the matter. You stick to the root of the problem, which is also at the same time the root of the solution. Basically the root of the fight that we're in. If you don't do that, then like people saw today, you can meet people that are well-intentioned but who are lost in issues. And they know so many issues that they forgot the essence of all those issues. And at the same time, we meet those people, which are not the majority. I think the majority of people we meet are just ignorant about, I wouldn't say everything, but about everything that relates to politics. Obama, why do you attack Obama? Give him some time. He's not George Bush. He's black. He's got to be better. He's got to be progressive, like women, you know. So we meet all these people, and I think the first thing that we have to really emphasize to them, instead of just necessarily going in length about everything that we know, I read Plato, I read this, I read that, okay, fine. But is the first is to help people admit that they don't know what they're talking about. That's actually a fight in itself, right? And the Obama issue is very simple in that sense because people just hope Obama is better. They don't know anything about Obama really, except maybe one person that was involved in the Obama campaign. And usually people, and from what I saw personally, people that got involved with Obama are sometimes even worse believers. They're believers. They don't know what they're talking about. But see, that's the thing. I think it's the first step for anyone who wants to become serious. Say, okay, well, actually, I really don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know Obama. I don't know his policies. Yes, he's better than George Bush, but you know, a roasted chicken is better than George Bush. Anything is better than George Bush, so that's not a reference. And to help people, It's important to go back in history, obviously, to go at this root of the matter. And because today, especially with this campaign around healthcare, but we have other examples of that, there's a lot of euphemisms that are used by the opponents or the enemy. No, while we talk about Nazi healthcare, these guys are talking about cost effectiveness. You know, and so on. There's others like that. But I made a discovery that actually the word euphemism is a euphemism.
What?
Well, yeah, yes, some of these words. You know, if you say the word cow, see, it refers to a cow. It refers to something outside the word. But euphemism is a euphemism. Well, it's when you say you want to say someone is fat, but you're gonna say, well, like you eat well or something like that, right? But yeah, it's a euphemism, meaning that it doesn't actually mean what it means. It means something else, and it's actually what I think it is. It's a euphemism for just outright lie. And just as an anecdote, but there's a very good euphemism that was used in history was actually during the time of the Nazis, where the technical name of the Nazis were not like big bad people. It was actually the National Socialist Party. So here you have these two words, National Socialist, which, well, actually it's more these type of words that, when put together, they kind of say, well, okay, it sounds like there's something you can do with that, but it actually doesn't mean anything. And in Europe, they have this big problem where, you know, it can be a left center, it can be a right center, you can be a Christian Democrat, you can be a Christian Socialist. So you have all these these names, but they don't mean squat. And the more you try to understand politics or history through these words, you get stupider and stupider and less able to intervene in society, because you have this mapping of words. And just like Obama, right? Well, Obama, isn't he a Democrat? Isn't he a socialist? Where the hell did you get that? What does that mean? You know, I think, Nancy Pelosi was a Democrat, and Felix Rahatin. So, and the problem is that, as we stated many, many times, that we have a population that sticks to, a population in general that sticks to their senses. Well, they stick to the first thing that they see, whether it's a word or whether it's an image. Obama being black, Obama doing whatever symbolic things that people will stick to. And at the same time, popular opinion will sometimes scare people who would like to ask the question, well, what do you mean? You know, like, what do you mean cost effectiveness? What does that mean? And sometimes people will say, we'll refrain from asking those questions. Because, look, what we're trying to stop is, and we try to maybe put it in more of a historical situated from a historical standpoint. And I think there's an important change that happened that we got. From our looking for information and ideas, is that actually this famous bill that we want to stop, this bill around healthcare, which they would like to ram through before October, now has a second thing attached to it, which is this cap and trade legislation, right? Which is important if you want to understand the whole problem. But the cap and trade, just very quickly, it's basically the idea of cap. So you have a cap in terms of emission of CO2, but you can trade to get the right to pollute more or emit more CO2. So if you're a farmer, that was an example that was given, but if you're a farmer and you manage somehow to cover the feces of pork.
Yeah, methane.
The stuff they use like to spread on your
manure?
Field.
Manure.
So if you manage to cover the manure, and you bring actually an expert from the stock market, or I don't know, from the government, and he's gonna check. Yeah, okay. So you get, let's say, you get 3 shares of that you can sell. So you can sell this right to pollute to some other company. And the idea is to have a broader trade for that right. So then people are saying, oh, we're going to tax the polluters. Well, the problem is that it is a taxation. It is an extra taxation on an economy which is crumbling. And already in Europe, for I think a year or so now, people have been trying that. And obviously, whether you run out of money or you run out of rights to pollute, right? And that was also a scheme. Maybe just quickly, but the scheme of the cap and trade is based also on this idea that African nations will be able to sell those polluting rights in order to pay their debt. That was also part of the how they sold the idea. Because, Africans don't produce anything, so say, maybe I can sell those rights to, I have this shitty company that produces nothing. So why don't I just sell? And you have stories of farmers in the U.S. actually selling, stopping the production of their crop. They'll actually get more money through selling those rights than actually producing the food. So, and LaRouche is clear. LaRouche says this, the cap and trade, is another genocidal policy, which is there to destroy industrial development. Right? Don't kid yourself that bad company is going to pay. Bad companies can't pay. No one can pay. Maybe HMO, maybe you should ask HMOs to give some money. But so I think it's an important twist of events that this bill is attached to. Basically, they want to pass both. Obama is convinced that he can pass both legislations very soon, because Obama is the man that can convince, bring people together.
Consensus building,
exactly. So, so just before getting into more history, but there is a emergency message by Mr. LaRouche, rather short, but something we put on our website, and there are 2 things in there which are, I think, important, and one which struck me as being a bit confusing, because he starts his message, usually he's going to talk about July 25th, 2007, when he made a forecast, or he's going to talk about the collapse of the economy or something like that. But this time he started by talking about the Air France destruction. So I stayed a bit, I was a bit, first I was confused, because then he goes into, look, put me there, otherwise say goodbye to your cat, your dog, your neighbor, everything is going to go unless I'm being brought in the picture. But what he says about Air France is important, and it's going to be important when we go more on the British side of things, because he says that after talking with experts, there are 2 hypotheses that are plausible for what happened with this plane. But these two hypotheses includes the idea of the cockpit having a bomb being put on the cockpit or inside. They're not too sure, but both hypotheses from experts talks about a bomb. What we've published pretty much since 2001 and even before that is that whenever you have a terrorist event, you can't just say, oh, these were a bunch of guys getting together and decide to make a bomb with Coca-Cola and Mentos, and they made a bomb. That's usually control. That's usually things that are done to destabilize countries. So LaRouche start with that, I think, to kind of set the tone, saying, well, look, we're not like in a magical world where everything is perfect. we are in a situation where the financial system is collapsing, and you're going to have a series of those events, a bit like the idea of the Guns of August theory, which says that when it's getting warm, when the weather is warm and the situation is hectic, unstable, you can even have wars that are being started. So
that was one thing.
Yeah.
You said two things.
Well, the other thing was basically we were saying, if you don't bring me in the picture, things are going to start collapsing. And there's also been, we have some new information about the state of mind of Obama and his relationship with the British. What, because, I mean, I think everyone got confused, especially in this movement.
He called him lunatic.
I'm sorry?
He called him lunatic.
Yeah. Well, he also says, I'm going to come back to that, but he also said that Obama's personality is not relevant, is nil, N-I-L.
His personality is nil?
Yeah, just give you the... his significance, Obama's significance as a person is nil, N-I-L. Yeah. That's a briefing. That's an internal discussion that occurred. I think it was Tuesday. Okay. So yeah. So we got more info about Obama, and LaRouche qualified Obama directly as a British agent. And the confusion arose when. I guess when Obama came in as a president, where he made a couple of cracks and about the British, did not receive very well the Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He got rid of the bust of Churchill. He gave a bunch of CDs to Brown. That was kind of funny. People thought it was like some type of, you know, pinching humor. But it was actually not the case, because if you go back a little bit, not only during the campaign can you find, because there was a chronology published in one of our briefing. In July 2008, Obama met with Tony Blair. And at least since then, it seemed that there's been a relationship with Blair and pot smoker, Her Royal Highness the Queen. a very silent relationship. And so you think, well, why then did he do that to Gordon Brown? Why did he laugh at Gordon Brown? And then Mr. LaRouche identified that the British government and the British factions, which are not necessarily the government, but actually they're not the government, but they are the financiers, people like taking care of the hedge funds, City of London, and the other faction, which is the British monarchy. And the British monarchy is getting the help of people like Tony Blair. And LaRouche identified both as being, in a sense, different, but still imperial, where you have a financial sector which might be more inclined to make some concessions about the financial system or whatever. But you have a British monarchy who is out there to kill a lot of people. And Tony Blair, from what we know from him, and if you just look a little bit, just very quickly, but Tony Blair first was one of the main proponents in 1997 of the Kyoto Agreement. Okay, and more recently, he was one of probably the main architect for the Iraq War. People tend to forget about that, but the 70 lies on the 70 facts on Barack, on Osama bin Laden, that came from him, right? Remember that? That was 2002. Maybe it was a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, 70 facts about why Obama did 9/11. It was just basically 70 facts about Osama bin Laden that he's darn evil, but it was nothing related to 9/11.
Right. I guess his summer home in London didn't make the list.
Huh?
His summer home in London didn't make the list, I guess.
Yeah, I mean.
So is 70 facts about Osama bin Laden?
Yeah. Why did 9/11? And I remember the last one, like, it was something like, Obama bin Laden is a very bad person talking against the nation or something. Like, coming out of nowhere, just these stupid facts.
We have to make an even number. Round it off.
That doesn't prove anything. It just says this guy is bad. Okay, well, and, you know, if you study a bit Obama, you see that he actually comes from those MI5 CIA networks. So, anyway, but he did these 70 lies. Huh?
You
mean
Osama.
Did I?
Said Obama.
Yeah.
Obama bin Laden?
They're not the same, right?
No, not. Well, we don't have any proof that they are. But he said that, and also he was the British were in charge of building up this so-called proof that Iraq received yellow cake from Nigeria. This, and they had Colin Powell on TV with this little beaker of a yellow cake, and we know it comes from Nigeria. We have this report, and it happened that the report was like,
what is it, the yellow cake?
I think it's enriched uranium. Which is kind of yellow,
okay.
Like a yellow powder that you use for a nuclear reactor. And if you look also at Afghanistan right now, well, that's maybe something else, but we know there's a very important British presence in Afghanistan, especially where they're producing the drugs. And the fact also that Obama has been asking for 21,000 more troops to Afghanistan, knowing the fact that he has a relationship with the British monarchy, doesn't help, because we know about the British kingdom being part of drug wars in the past, just like today. The situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan is very extremely, extremely dangerous because of that. So you have Tony Blair, also a man who actually denied that the Westphalian principles were still useful. That was in 1999, I think, in Chicago. And then you have Gordon Brown that we've known more recently because he, the first one who came at the defense of the hedge funds while nations were talking about a new financial system. You had the Russians, the Chinese. We thought we had a certain ear. People were listening to LaRouche's proposal, but this guy came in with other people as well to basically shut down any type of real reorganization. Just make sure that we have some, maybe the IMF can take care of things, these sort of things.
Brown has a hard time with
Tony Blair?
Gordon Brown,
he's in trouble. Yeah. What I was trying to just picture a little bit was this British faction, this British imperial factional fight between people around Gordon Brown, the City of London, and Tony Blair and the monarchy, because now there's an attempt to get rid of Gordon Brown, just to kick him out.
Isn't this scandal was that created maybe to get him out?
You know, it's like it's a bit like here. You can create scandals. Like, you smoke pot? Yeah, okay, you're dead. No. these sort of scandals that don't necessarily mean much. You know, he received that money and that money, but the idea is to get rid of the guy. And in the last elections, the Labour, which is the party of Brown, didn't do very well. Obviously, the economic situation is so bad, so it's very obvious to blame the guy there and say, well, let's put someone else instead. So you got that fight, which also, and that brings LaRouche to say, well, look, Obama is also into this factional fight. And the fact that he wants to do these two legislations together says a lot. And he also compared, that's another thing which I have still to look more into, but he compared...
Sorry, JP, sorry to cut you off, but you're developing the idea that Obama is not merely a Narcissus personality, but that he's actually a bona fide British agent?
Yeah. Well, LaRouche says, he also says that, like talking about the idea of treason, he says we have a treasonous president, but I'm not sure that Obama gets the idea of what treason is.
Like he's not winning in a certain sense? He's not a winning
agent? I guess. LaRouche considers Obama as very confused.
That's right.
To say the least.
Lunatic?
Probably.
So if he's a British agent, it's more just because he is so, he's controllable and controlled.
He's very controllable because of this, I guess, this ego, this neurotic, narcissistic ego. And he's been developed, think about just the campaign, you know? Think about this. You know, if you're being told you're a semi-god, sometimes it might get to you, you know? Mm-hmm. Or just think about all these Hollywood starlets, you know? They think of themselves as like semi-gods, like pagan gods, a bunch of, you know? So it can get, I think that's what was happening during the campaign, and that's still happening today, that they're building his character as we said, the man of the consensus. The man who can bring people together, although they're actually the opposite, and doesn't, you know, we know where it's going towards, you know, the British monarchy or the financiers. It's not going towards the people. But so, I mean, there's more to say about maybe his personality. But LaRouche, as I was saying, says, don't see Obama as a personality or a person. But see him as a political event, right? That actually is the whole geometry around Obama, which makes us very suspicious about this idea of him being a British agent, right? There's something to quote, maybe. No.
No, Meredith said a bona fide British agent, what do you mean?
Oh, I mean, like, just a British agent, in fact.
Oh,
it's paid. Well, no, not necessarily paid, but it's different from a... Well, it sounds like what JP is developing is the idea that it's not just that he is ignorant and confused. There's an added element that he's actually... at least controlled enough to be a deployed agent of the British Empire.
Yeah, you don't just
that
say he might be, but that he actually is.
He's doing what they're telling.
So, and the other thing I wanted to mention about basically LaRouche on Obama, but he made this comparison, which I'm not too clear about, but I can elaborate a bit on the content, on the context. Is that he compared Obama to, said he's a traitor just like James Buchanan, who was a former president. And then they referred a couple of chapters in there, but it's the chapter goes into the context of the situation of how Buchanan was a traitor. And maybe just very quickly, because it's important, especially after the deployments we had this week, to understand maybe a little bit more in this context, but... It was before Lincoln were to be a president. And at that time, you had an international movement called Young Europe, being led by people like Mazzini. I'm not going to say too much because I don't want... But basically, you had this Young Europe and then Young America. You had the Young Turks. There was also something similar to Canada. I forget the name, but Pepino was cut into that. And the idea is that basically you have factions bringing chaos, where a potential for a republic or potential for economic development is replaced by something else. And in the case of the United States, there was this whole idea of this fake debate between do we have slavery? You had people saying we are going to have slavery. People like Lincoln were saying, no slavery, and we keep the Union together. And you had other people saying, well, how about we just like free blacks, but let's keep them on their in their own little thing, right? Let's put them in some, I guess it's segregation, pretty much, right? Colored bathroom, colored country, you know. Yeah, and same people were seeing the flaw into that, but the young Europe, who was also partly directly racist, saying that because one of the first things that Buchanan did when he came to power as a president was to repeal a law which forbade slavery in Kansas. And the first thing that when when the president Pierce came in was the president before Buchanan was an ambassador to England, and the book goes more into the details of it, but basically he had an intent at that time to not only break the United States into parts but also to break the South American republics or potential republics. With this idea of the war with Mexico that was, I don't know if it was over, but it was during that time where the United States went to war for a fight over a little piece of river. It was very stupid. But the idea was just to trigger a war. So I think it's a relevant, it's a relevant comparison, especially that it brings back this idea that the enemy of the United States, which is also the enemy of civilization itself, is this idea of empire. That it's not unlike some people might think, people would just get stuck with maybe the facts. It's not a question of financial control or getting rich, and you know, it's not that human beings are greedy and the one with money, they're greedier, so they want to have more money. But it's really a question of control. And the only way an empire can keep control is by, like, if you take, for example, the idea of slavery, right? Well, if you want to have slavery, not only do you have to keep the slaves backward, right, and make sure that you don't teach them anything, like even counting, because you want to keep the fact that you say, well, these people are backward. But not only do you keep the slave backward, but you got to keep everyone backward, because it's very easy to say, "Well, look, this is human beings. You know, bring him with me for 3 months. I'll show him how to count, read, and you know, sing." Right. So you got to keep everyone backward. And what we know about the British Empire is that they managed to get a little bit smarter by not attacking everything about science. Because at the time, if you look in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, mankind is making progress. Mankind is having a railroad, is having mills, steam engines, and so on and so forth. So you can't just pretend that creativity does not exist. You got to kind of play with it. So you allow certain things to happen, but you make sure that people stay stupid. And it brings you back to this question of euphemism, or this idea of senses, because anything that comes out of Great Britain in terms of ideology is a very sensual one, and also stupid when you look at it. And it brings us back to, well, you're asking yourself, what was the problem with the British? And one of the problems that you see in their thinkers and in the way they do politics is that you have this, as Nick Walsh was saying in his class, there is this hatred of human beings, and there is this attempt to always have a population in control. And the figure that I have in mind, since I did some work on it, is obviously a man named Thomas Malthus, this economist who was one of the most known economists that was talking about population control. And the problem is that if you just mention Malthus as a reference, you just expose yourself as not knowing anything about science. And that's very simple, because if you just read the preface of any of his editions of
Essays on Population.
Yeah, Essays on Population. There's no science whatsoever. The book is based on what we should do about the people, about population control. How do we do that? But the way he justifies it is just saying, he's actually admitting that mankind managed to outgrow its production of food compared to its population. He's admitting that. But then he says, no, not twice. Did it once, right? But you didn't do it twice. Come on. And then you start looking at the numbers, you know. And if you grow geometrically and you get to, you know, if you have a population of 100,000 billion, well, you're not going to be able to produce enough food for them. It's obvious, right? That's the basis of Malthus. So any ecologist bring back Malthus has to be told, well, you don't know anything about science because you like Malthus. Malthus was actually one of those people who were doing propaganda for the interests of the British Empire. And you also have something else that comes in the same lineage, which is this question of a eugenics, right? Again, in this idea of having population control, you can't really deny science is there, but you can actually say that there's a bunch of people that are pretty stupid because they can't figure it out. Like, you know, like Africans and Spaniards, like the poor. And if you're poor, you gotta be stupid, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not poor. I can read, I can write, I can
sing. Without the oil, they just don't do it.
Exactly. So then what you bring about is a difference. You don't deny creativity, but you say it's not everyone. And just look at the facts and look at the British population, much more well-fed than these countries and these poor and these ghettos, these Irish. And then there's the science that goes with it. And that brings us more towards the Nazis, because as we kept saying, the Nazis did not invent bad things. If you look at the British Empire, if you think that concentration camps was bad, just think about human trade. Think about treating human beings of every age. Think about these slave owners that, you know, will check if a slave is good by opening his mouth and checking his teeth. That's the type of mentality you got to deal with. So, I mean, I don't want to go into like all the details, but to me, there's a lot of similarities between what the Nazis could do and what the British were doing. Just grabbing people. Saying, you're mine, I'm going to sell you. See, so so it sticks to that idea of how do we control the population? And a good way to do that is also euphemism, as I was saying. The idea, for example, of cost effectiveness, euphemism, or just the fact that, you know, when you have a population that gets, gets just stupider, not because it wants to, but because it's being trained to stay stupid, it's very easy to actually believe anything and to not look into the cause of things, right? And that's what we've been doing with this healthcare policy. Because the healthcare policy, or the cap and trade, that I'm going to maybe talk a bit more later, but you're dealing with actually imperial policies that are being implemented under different guises, right? Obama is being there saying, let's cut healthcare, we're going to take the punch, we've got to take the hit altogether. Let's do it, and then that'll be for future generations. But then at the same time, you have the same utilitarian vision of man that he had with slave trade, or that he had with the Nazis, saying, well, these guys are okay, let's make measurements, let's measure their crane, let's measure this, let's measure that. Or what you do is that you have this, you kind of fool people by pretending you're scientific by developing this, as they call it, a health I think it's called a health calculus. Yeah, I'm scientific and I'm doing math. So, and then you start evaluating life based on these what's called quality adjusted life years. And if you're not passing the test, you don't get the treatment you need. But still, it doesn't necessarily. See, the problem is that, and that's why I think we have to get at with people. People will say about policies, well, why don't we just try it and see what happens? You know, about free trade. Well, you'll see. Free trade is very good. You'll see. In 2 years, you'll thank us. Oh, I guess. Let's try. Let's try this new healthcare. Let's try this. But then you ask yourself, well, is there a way that we can know before we implement? Like, is there like indications or did we ask enough questions? Did we ask any question about this? Did we just took their words? We're the National Socialist Movement. We'll take care of the nation and the people, National Social. Let's try. Right? So.
Why is it difficult to, when we say, for example, Obama is May or showing signs as being a British agent?
Uh huh.
There were also some other presidents also insulted.
They were British agents?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Then why can't they get into trouble? Because if you're a president of a country, you should be for that country, not for another country. Is there any way in America they can identify traitors?
Yeah.
Or it is impossible to distinguish. Like Kissinger was an agent.
Yeah.
The British, even when
yes.
when was a secretary of state.
Yeah. I think.
Is there any way we can identify even by thoughts or by actions the man who stole American or an agent?
Yeah.
It should be somewhere.
Oh, it is feasible, but the problem we get. People will say the problem is that people don't know their history. So if you say, hey, here's a British agent, a lot of people will say, well, don't we have this beautiful relationship with Great Britain since Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and blah, blah, blah. Or don't we go have parties together like once a year about this World War II thing? Wasn't Roosevelt the friend of Churchill? Right? So there's no in-depth knowledge about the history, because we've been saying that to about Kissinger, you know, about Obama now, but as we're saying about Buchanan and others, Alarush has been very vehement identifying a bunch of traitors
yeah.
in the United States since the last since the beginning of the revolution, that you have traitors because you're in a war. The war doesn't end just because you stop shooting your enemy. But there's an attempt to subvert, and LaRouche published works on, for example, the impotency of U.S. intelligence, like CIA or FBI, because they don't get history, unlike Edgar Allan Poe or James Fenimore Cooper, who were. They knew the enemy. They knew that the great British Empire didn't just disappear under. Okay, now we'll stop. Okay, we'll free everyone. Like, we lost. Too bad. It didn't happen. They just kept the power in a different way.
And
so
like when Truman, for example, Harry Truman.
Yeah.
When Franklin Roosevelt died, and then he came to power,
mm-hmm.
and he started reversing or twisting. All
yeah.
Did people notice that it was twisting?
I think they would.
Would they say anything?
Well, when you're in the Cold War and there's a witch hunt against any commies, you might just stop talking. I think that's what happened. You know, because in the United States, if you were a commie, they would run after you. And so people got scared. And that's usually what happens when situation changed like that.
Because in France, they have the fifth column.
Yeah.
Called something in French, the cinquième colonne.
Mm-hmm.
It means someone in government, but working for a foreign interest.
Yeah.
So maybe in America it should happen. Because when I see whatever they say about Obama or Kissinger, or
I think they call it a traitor. No?
Yeah.
They call it a traitor. I mean, there's something called treason. That is punishable by law, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. They get impeached, they get thrown in jail.
I mean, a couple of times they're trying to succeed and they didn't because then the traitor was identified.
No, it's not impossible. It was done, and we do it because we know history.
Showing the title of the book there from Anthony Shepkin, it's about that.
Yeah, like that, yeah. That's that.
Prison America.
Yeah, so. Yeah, there's a lot of detail there, so that I guess that's a good book to get the idea of how you identify a guy who's treasonous. Let me just go back to the National Socialist stuff. Those National Socialists. So the idea is that there's legislation that they want to pass very quickly. Want to pass it secretly. Fortunately, I guess, well, unfortunately for them, but I think the last few weeks we've managed to expose these people, I think 3 or 4 times, or maybe 5, during their own public meetings, where not much is being said anyway, you know. They say, well, you're going to read the report later, but we did that work and that went well. The speech, and we published one of the speeches in the latest EIR, but it's very shallow until we come in and then say, well, you guys talking about cost effectiveness, isn't that just another word for rationing? Isn't that another word for just giving cares to only those worth living? Isn't that the Nazi policies? And the response is panic. The response is, shit, now we're exposed. And it's important to think about that because we're not the only one against that. There's a motion around the John Conyers, right? There's an attempt to have a single payer healthcare system. And the single payer is that, I guess, the government pays with the tax, you know, you don't. You have your insurance, but you don't have to pay for everything, just like yourself. And just to give you an idea, maybe quick, but there was a member in when I was in Philadelphia, there was a member who had a problem with her heart, the aorta, and she had to go through a lot of things. She had to get her thing cleaned.
What's it called?
Le rein.
Kidney.
Oh, yeah. Dialysis. And she showed me the bill. The typical bill she would have if she hadn't paid, and it was $700,000. But she had insurance. She had group insurance. Because she would go to the hospital. She couldn't, she had to clean up her kidney every day, right? And that's the thing, right? With the healthcare, it's important to think. It's an important statistics, but.
Just a question. How long was this treatment?
She spent like probably a month or so at the hospital, but she had to go to the hospital every, like twice a day. Clean up her. She didn't have the machine to have their own kidney thing.
But that she has to do for all her life.
Well, I guess until a certain point, like she couldn't buy the machine. She could have bought the machine, but the guy was saying, "Look, the electricity bill is gonna kill you. It's not like having a car in your house. You know, it's a lot of energy." But and also the other point is that in healthcare. 80%, that's in the United States, but it's probably the same everywhere. 80% of your treatment are given to 20% of the patients because these are chronic. Right? Think about those kids spending, you know, going to the, spending a lot of time in hospitals, chronic diseases, old people can spend a lot of time in hospital. So they take a lot of these quote-unquote ineffective treatment. So yes, yeah, so we expose those people, and as I was saying, Conyers, who's has I think it's 79 or 80 people that co-signed his bill. The problem is that they're fighting like little girls, right? They don't. You gotta call a Nazi, otherwise. I didn't want to be rude to little girls, but I'm sure they can fight maybe better. But yeah, they're having this academic fight. And to give you a sense of this type of fight, remember, keep in mind, right, that the first bailout policy was rammed through again. Congressmen were scared shitless about having martial law or something like that. These are like propaganda campaign. They're done very quickly, very hard, and they try to ram through stuff. And it usually passed because people are not fighters. John Conyers has some good ideas here and there. And you know, he was leading this fight to expose vote fraud when George Bush got his second term. But the guy is not a fighter. So he's getting a popular support, but he's not getting anything accomplished. Right? So we're taking those bills and saying, well, that's the way to go, but you got to call a Nazi. Otherwise, you're not going to go anywhere. You're going to actually fail to do what you want to do, because that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with Nazis, and Nazis, like they did in 39, the T4 law, which was talking about these lives unworthy to be lived, was a secret legislation. And the killing was also secret for a while. Which brings me to a concrete example in the state of Oregon, right? Where the state of Oregon, since 1994, they started this healthcare plan where they would start, they actually called that the well-being index, which is different than quality adjusted life years, but which is the same utilitarian approach to life. So the first thing to say, because I just wanted to stress this question of the Nazi relation, that it's not just a bunch of guys that, because you could technically you could have a private healthcare system, I mean, at least partially, where people actually they want to care for people. That's possible, you know. That's not because you're so private that you're evil. It's called the well-being index. Can you maybe get the. Yeah, the quality of well-being index. And so this project had two aspects of it, which is this well-being index and the legalization of euthanasia. Although, if you get the euthanasia thing, the law itself does not ask for a taking down of the euthanized people. You don't have to take prendre note. You don't have to
account for.
So it's done in secret. There are certain estimates that we have, which are between maybe 600 to 800 people, and so that's there, but at the same time, when you die, what it says on your certificate of death is natural death, mm-hmm. Right?
Not doctor-assisted suicide.
No, they don't say that. They say, because it actually has, what you need is that you need two physicians that are there. They give you the pill and you take it yourself, right? And obviously the case, and that it gives you a good sense of how you can our society degenerate morally is when there was a lady called Barbara Wagner who had a cancer, and she asked for a drug that would keep her in shape for a couple of months, and the drug is $4,000. So she received a letter from the hospital saying, yeah, well, look, we're not going to pay for that, but if you need palliative care, we'll pay for that. And palliative is when you're gonna die. That there's no hope. You're gonna die. So my sister was working in that for a little while, and they just, you know, they say come to the hospital, we'll take care of you until you die. There's not much you can do. like terminal illness. But the woman said, well, look, give me the drug, I'll stay stay alive. They said, well, yeah, but we can afford the palliative care, especially that the drugs to kill you is only $100, right?
Wow.
And the lady actually had to fight that, right? So it's, and it's the same thing you see with the system in Oregon, or also, I'll just say a few words about the British system, is that if it wasn't for many, many fights from the population, whew, it would be ugly. It would be very ugly, right? So in a sense, like because the British system, the NICE system, which I keep forgetting what it means, but
the National Institute for Healthcare Excellence.
Yeah, National Institute for Healthcare. Yeah, some care and excellence.
No help though.
Yeah. I'll just maybe say a few things.
You can also say for NICE,
nice. They take the health out of healthcare, but it's nice.
Yeah.
Citizen eradication. Yeah.
That's pretty
Nazi
much it.
Inspired citizen eradication.
Oh shit.
Okay, that's in the before last June 5 EIR.
That somewhere in the briefing, I think.
Okay.
So I'll just give the five examples that are there, just to give you a sense of how the Nazi parts start, right? Because you got to think, you know, do these people really ignore the consequences of their action? I mean, do they know? Are they like really? Gee, I didn't know, right? Yeah, that's, I mean, you can be stupid, but you say, well, isn't that going to kill people? No.
No,
it's not going to.
What do you mean by kill?
And I think that's...
I'm just saying talk, but I got to beat the traffic.
So I'll give you five examples, and all these were fought against. Okay, first... In the case of Alzheimer's disease, NICE has tried to limit patients from using the drugs Aricept, Exelon, and Remenil by ruling that they can be prescribed only for those with moderate Alzheimer's symptoms, but not those in the early stages of the disease. NICE brushed aside the research studies showing that patients have shown, quote, an excellent response to treatment after just 5 months, right? So a drug that actually does work doesn't make you, like, it doesn't stop Alzheimer's, but it makes you better. So, no, we're going to stop that. The other one, in the case of breast cancer, NICE has tried to stop patients from having access to the drug Aricept. After a big protest movement, limited NHS use was permitted in 2006. NHS being the National Health System, which is kind of a Medicare type of thing, which allows treatment for people. So limited NHS use was permitted in 2006. In the case of osteoporosis, NICE has restricted the use of the medicine Protelos. And two others. In the case of kidney cancer, the drug Sutent was disallowed. Following protests by physicians as well as patients in January 2009, NICE acquiesced to permitting limited use. And the last one. In the case of multiple sclerosis, NICE has ruled out beta interferon treatments. In 2001, it ruled that the clinical benefits appear to be outweighed by a very high cost of the drug. Whereas 15 people of continental European multiple sclerosis sufferers receive the drug, only 1% of such patients do in the UK. Okay, so that's... So the idea is that, yeah, I mean, what are the consequences of that? And do you want to face that? Do people want to face that? And that's why I have to be rough with people. And we can't just... I mean, people are such in a... are so convinced about Obama, especially here. It's like this guy who's going to change the United States. No. But no one knows anything about it. especially not the policies being proposed. I mean, the Americans are starting to know about it because we've exposed it, and even that, certain of the people that we exposed at meetings that should have been made public through video, through C-SPAN, and it wasn't done. Like the one that we transcribed in the EIR, actually was done by us. If we hadn't been there, no one would have known about it, except the few people that were there. So we got this thing, and at the same time, we have, as I was saying, the cap and trade proposal. And then again, if you look, we were talking about, you know, slave trade, talking about eugenics. And then again, right, if you want to have population control, the best way, or I guess the newest way, is to tell people, well, look, you know, I'm not going to kill those beautiful snails just so that you can have your river or your water. And it takes a while to sink in, but it did sink in during Nazi Germany, where I actually found the I hadn't seen it yet. It was this video about the story of Hans Über, I forget his name, Überlichtet, who is this guy who actually joined the conservation movement in Nazi Germany to quickly realize that, because it was all this thing about the Jews and the capitalists from the United States destroyed our environment, destroyed our beautiful German homeland. Make sure our homeland will grow again. Let's have trees, let's have this, let's have that. And what Überlichtet realized at the end is that, because he was, before he were to go to World War II, because he was a plane, was a pilot, he says, well, I'm going to go in nature like a week. So he bring his pack I guess it was dry raisins or peanuts or something. You know, like, to do a cleansing, you know, type of thing. And he gets close to the forest at some place. And obviously, he sees a fire, he sees all these trees crushed, and then he sees all these planes, these tanks, these jeeps. He says, what? And then he's going to go complain to the Nazi SS. And he says, you destroyed the environment. And then the guy says, well, you really think the conservation movement was about the environment? And the video ends like that. it's on the page, Green Fascism.
Okay.
Very good, it's very...
But isn't it, like, just to say about Germany at the time and embracing environmentalism, how did they do that and at the same time, like, they built the republic on, basically on industry?
Well, that's what they had before the Versailles Treaty. Germany was growing, was it? They had a certain sector of Germany that was producing a lot in terms of steel, coal, all these sort of, well, not about steel, but coal. The Ruhr region. But the problem that happened is that with the Versailles Treaty, then all this was dismantled. Well, a lot of it, not everything, but a lot of it. And then you get, you know, when people are weak, in a weak state, you kick in some propaganda about our fatherland and, you know, German homeland. And they actually had this spin of saying, We're just gonna have German plants. Cactus, you know, no cactus, no orange tree. German plants. German animals, whatever that means.
Eugenics for plants.
Yeah, there was the idea of think about this idea of purity.
Yeah.
You know, we know about their fight for pure race. Well, you gotta purify everything if you wanna purify a homeland. Yeah.
But
plants.
They had also like this guy, Louis Trenker. He was a famous actor, and he became in Nazi Germany really a big guy because all his films were about the mountains and, you know,
okay.
And stuff, right?
German mountains. And it was all based around, again, the hatred of the Jews and the capitalists who were destroying. It was kind of, okay, they got screwed by the United States and everyone, that's for sure. But so basically, from eugenics and from more the idea of population control. You have these ideas, and that's the problem with environmentalism today. There's no science whatsoever, especially because of what I talked about, the simple idea of Malthus being present in a so-called science is a proof that you're stupid. And the way things have been dealt with, as I was saying at the beginning, sense perception. And the best example for that is a new movie called Home, right? Which I had the chance of watching, which is nice to look at because it's all these beautiful images, which are very beautiful, with this little twist. You know, when you see, it's all these images like about maybe like, I don't know, like 200 meters high, and all these colors. And obviously you start with a bunch of mountains and trees and so on, and then you show backward economies, people like, you know, grabbing cotton or grabbing whatever, rice, and then the narrator says, "Oh, but despite that, people's life expectancy was very low. People didn't know how to read," and then you start changing the music, and then you get into the industry. And they even try to scare you about the fact that you hear the guy, so funny. He says, the United States can produce food for 2 billion people. And they try to scare you with that. You should say, well, isn't that a good thing?
Right? Am I complaining or what?
So yeah, that's good, you know. And then they show you these images, which looks very dry compared to the colors of the Amazon or whatever. All gray, it's all brown, you know, and gray, or brown and brownish, and that's the tenure of the movie. And I'm sure that the guy doesn't say he's a scientist, the guy Bertrand who made the movie, but we know how these are being used, right? They're being used to get people very, very soft on the issue. Should we save our Mother Earth? Well, is it in danger? Isn't it? Well, they say no. Oh. Just by saying that, you might get a lot of more people to start reacting intelligently. And we've got to expose the truth about that, this idea of the British or the imperial brutish aspect of environmentalism. Because it will, with this, if the Obama crew and the British manage to pass these two laws together, the cap and trade and the Nazi healthcare policy, I mean, there's not going to be much hope. And at the same time, maybe just as a parenthesis, but the other thing, which again involves the British controlling nations like Russia and China, but which is the dumping of the dollar, which I haven't talked too much, but it's an attempt to really bankrupt the whole world, right? This idea of chaos, right? No, it's like you have people that are like satanic. They just wish that everything would die around them instead of losing control. You know, these other guys that says, well, you know, like type of baby boomers says, well, I don't want to die. And they're still going to make some concessions to like the people saying that we've got to develop human beings and so on and so forth. But that's an important policy, and the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Brazilians, the group named BRIC, B-R-I-C, through intervention in Russia, especially by the British, with people remember the finance minister Kudrin, that we've exposed as being a British agent since a couple of trips he made in England and completely flipped, changed, and influenced the Russians, who showed a certain... Yeah, he's a finance minister of Russia, and just brought the Russians and the Chinese and others in this policy of, you know, let's vary, let's have a basket of currency in which we're going to invest. So they want to get away from the U.S. dollar, and not that we.
A basket of currency.
Well, instead of having reserves in just one currency.
Instead of a market basket.
Like a smorgasbord.
Yeah. So,
but no bread.
So
only money. That's what I brought to the picnic.
Yeah, but during the G20 in London,
yeah,
in March, Obama and the other people agreed that they were going to create another money and not a monetary unit.
Well, they would agree with this idea that we've got to bail out banks and use the IMF as a tool to kind of arrange the whole crisis. And that's what the Brazilian did, right? They bought, I think it's $10 billion special drawing rights, which is this kind of currency that the IMF has. And they say, well, you know, it's giving us a good interest rate, so we're going to keep doing that. The problem is that you're going to blow the whole world if you do that. So it's not because the U.S. dollar has a value. It has a value because everyone is kind of caught with it. So if you just devalue that, it's going to create chaos. So Rush says, well, keep that valuable, but make sure that that you're going to have gradually a currency which is valuable based on the economy, per se, the real production of the nation, or the, as they did with Hamilton, where the value of the currency was based on the potential of the American Republic, the newly born. They say, you foreigners that bought our U.S. dollars, keep them because we're going to change the world. We're going to have this economy. It's going to blow. It's going to bloom. And that's what they did. So then the value stayed, and people were happy to have U.S. bonds. But then again, that's the other part where we have to kick in with this idea of a credit system, this idea of a new Bretton Woods, where we're not going to, where we got to break with this imperial design of cheap labor, or this idea that there's one better than the other, there's one who's purer than the other, there's one that has to suffer, and, you know, too bad, that's how things goes.
And in London, instead of eliminating this white elephant and IMF,
mm-hmm,
the contrary happened, that they allowed even more billion of money, is that?
In Great Britain?
No, when they when they met the
G20. G20, yeah.
Instead, we advocate to eliminate the IMF.
No, they said they would keep the IMF as a regulatory body. This would manage this financial crisis through the IMF because it's an international body. Blah 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 blah. So
did they increase its role?
Well, probably will, but the idea is that's the recipe for a world government. Right, because you put your money in an institution like the Brazilians are doing. You put your money in an institution it represents many nations, but it's pretty much controlled by Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. These are the three nations giving more money to the IMF. So you're basically going to this idea of a world government, this idea of a world led by a bunch of wise guys. Who, you know, as Bertrand Russell and Prince Philip, keep saying, you know, well-fed people, you know, we got to deal with the mess that stupid people are doing. It's going to be messy, but we got to control the population. We have to reduce people's number. It's disgusting, but since we're that smart, it doesn't bother us because we're going to do it, and we're going to do it for... There's in the in June 8th briefing, there's a bunch of those quotes.
Really high-minded people have no concern for happiness, especially other people's.
These are just like...
There was a Christian Russell quote for why we have to kill off happiness.
Real high-minded people have no concern for other people's people's happiness.
Yeah.
Especially other people.
Yeah, I can give you two quotes, but just the Bertrand Russell, which is a bit more known, well, I guess through the movement. But so Lord Bertrand Russell is a great philosopher, supposedly a pacifist.
Nobel Prize winner.
He's the one who first talked about preemptive strike on the Soviet Union, nuclear preemptive strike, so not very stable individual. But he says in one of his books, The Impact of Science on Society, he says, but bad times, you may say, are exceptional and can be dealt with by exceptional methods. This has been more or less true during the honeymoon period of industrialism, but it will not remain true unless the increase of population can be enormously diminished. At present, the population of the world is increasing at about 58,000 per diem. War so far has had no very great effect on this increase, which continued through each of the world wars. War has hitherto been disappointing in this respect, but perhaps bacteriological war may prove more effective. If a black death could spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full. The state of affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it? Really high-minded people are indifferent to happiness, especially other people's. So that's...
What is also
one of the
Yeah, so...
By the way, beer's in the fridge. You know, like...
And this, and Ross also represents a whole family of, is I think his father, his grandfather was foreign minister to Great Britain. It's probably his father because it was in the 1830, 50.
Yeah, Lord John Russell.
Yeah, Lord John Russell. And then a quote from Prince Philip.
I think it's his grandfather.
C'est quoi dans la, what's the report that was saying you got to eliminate the French Canadians? Durham report.
There's a resolution, yeah. Lord Durham.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll just give you the quote from... I'm going to give you this quote, and then maybe we should have... June 8th. I can send you the quote if you want. I'm just going to say that.
Who said that we should eliminate the French Canadians?
It was, well, was this this report, the Durham report?
Durham.
That was in the 1830s or 40s. Say, just get rid of those. They don't want to mingle with us. Anyway, Prince Philip, and then let Pascal speak, and then I'm going to close.
Also, I mean, there, I don't know if you brought this up yet, but the they just up the swine flu.
Yes, that is
level 6 from 5.
I thought of it, but I didn't mention it. I mean, there's other things.
It just flows from what you just read.
Yeah. So, Prince Philip, from The Prospect of Industrial Civilization, 1923. So, yeah. So he says, the white population of the world will soon cease to increase. The Asiatic races will be longer, and the Negroes still longer, before their birth rate falls sufficiently to make their numbers stable without help of war and pestilence. Until that happens, the benefits aimed at by socialism can only be partially realized, and the less prolific races will have to defend themselves against the more prolific by methods which are disgusting, even if they are necessary.
Who wrote that?
Prince Philip. You can't. Yeah.
He's that old. 1923. You wrote
the case.
Oh no! Yeah, I misread. That's yeah, because it was written Prince Philip, but that's for the rest. Sorry, that was that was Bertrand Russell.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But Prince Philip, you know, I wish to be a virus.
I wish to be a virus. He's like a student.
I like that. What was that, the virus?
Well, he's. As I was saying, Russell is part of this imperial family. So when you're from the empire, you go to imperial university. Yeah, so you tend to think.
You're also a product of inbreeding.
Yeah.
But, I mean, these guys are just crazy. I remember, I think it was Prince Philip who went to, he went to Rwanda, or him or his father, and they went to Rwanda to talk about the extinction of the white gorillas. Like Rwanda, Kadiba. They had just had a genocide, and he goes there, let's save the gorillas. It's like, where you live, you know? So so I just want to let Pascal give a report on this mobilization. on the Conference of the Americas, and I'm going to open for questions, and then I'm going to do my geometry thing after the Q&A.